It's been 33 years since homosexuality was decriminalised in Ireland, and just 11 years since marriage equality became the law. But behind that progress are men who, in the years before those changes, were criminalised simply for exploring their sexuality. Now, decades later, the state is finally preparing to disregard those convictions. It's News Talk Daily. I'm Ciara Doherty. And for some of our younger listeners, I would say it's perhaps a bit shocking to learn that for more than a century in Ireland, consensual same-sex relations were crimes. In the decades before 1993, hundreds and hundreds of men were prosecuted in Ireland under laws related to what was called gross indecency. Almost 1,700 men were brought before the courts, and more than 900 were actually convicted. And this was done through active enforcement. We're talking about Ar Gardaí, Ar Garda Síochána, carrying out surveillance on men. Men were named and shamed in court, their addresses printed in newspapers. Some went to prison. These laws shaped how society really viewed gay life. And as an aside, if you'd like to get a really good insight into what life was like for gay men in Ireland in the years before decriminalisation, be sure to listen to a brilliant podcast here on News Talk. It's called Inside the Crime, The Charles Self Murder, in which Frank Graney explores the unsolved killing of a gay man in Dublin back in 1982. But even after decriminalisation in 1993, those men's convictions remained on record. A state apology did come in 2018, but it didn't erase a criminal record. Now, after decades of campaigning, legislation is finally being prepared to formally disregard those convictions for consensual same-sex activity. And that is much more than just a formality for campaigners who want a sincere recognition of what we now accept and understand was a real violation of human rights. I'm joined today by one such campaigner, co-founder of the LGBT Restorative Justice Campaign, Kieran Rose. Kieran, you're very welcome to News Talk Daily Studios. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much.
I mentioned there at the very top that I do think some of our younger listeners who have lived in a country where men have been free to express their love and desires without fear of the law for more than 30 years now, where we've had same-sex marriage in this country for over a decade. But for many gay men out there, say who are aged 50 or over, things were just so different for them when they came out or when they tried to live their life as a gay person.
Absolutely. I mean, it's great that there's a whole cohort of young people who don't remember being criminalised and who, you know, who take the fact of greater equality for LGBT people, take it for granted. And that's really great. But it's really important, I think, that we remember and redress, in a sense, the awful human rights violations that resulted from the criminalisation. And, you know, as you were saying, that criminalisation existed, bizarrely, up to 1993. And I think, in a sense, it's one of the worst human rights violations by the Irish state since 1922. And we're familiar with the other ones, you know, the industrial schools, the mother and babies homes, the Magdalen laundries and so on. You know, the Irish state and the Irish people have taken steps to redress those human rights violations, not completely, and people aren't happy with what has been done and not enough has been done. But this is great that the government is and the opposition are all committed to introducing disregard legislation, which would mean that the records, the criminal records of those men and juveniles, because, you know, there were 15 and 16 year olds who were all before the district court and the circuit court. And there's evidence, you know, there's a historical example of a 17 year old who was put into Mountjoy Junior Prison for a consensual sexual relationship. So it's historic that it's happening, as you say, 33 years later. It's really right and proper that it's happening. And it's great that programmes like yours are covering it, because I think a very important part of what we need to do and what's part of restorative justice is to remember the men and the juveniles who were traumatized by being criminalized, even by being arrested if you weren't charged, by being prosecuted even if you weren't convicted. And if you were convicted and not sent to jail or just given a suspended sentence, I mean, that was traumatic for people and for their families and for their communities. And I'm sure a lot of people emigrated, so there'll be a huge task for the Department of Justice, and I think they're up for it, to reach out to our emigrant cities in countries, in places like Australia, Britain, United States and so on.
Obviously this will have had the greatest impact, as you say, the greatest trauma on the individuals who were arrested and indeed went before a judge and were prosecuted and indeed spent perhaps time in prison. But it must have created this awful environment for all men who were engaging in sexual relations, consensual sexual relations at the time, because that risk would have been hanging over you all of the time. The risk of prosecution, the risk of arrest, the risk, and perhaps the most damaging part of all, of that public shaming. What was that like?
Well, it was terrible, especially for people, I suppose, you know, who were in the closet, like most gay men would have been at the time. So they would have felt very alone and isolated, you know, if they were arrested, and they wouldn't have a clue what to do, who... They couldn't tell their family, they couldn't probably tell their colleagues at work or their friends. You know, they were probably scared of going to a solicitor to get, you know, legal advice and so on. So for those people, it was kind of doubly and trebly traumatic.
It was the fear of being outed.
Totally. And then all of the consequences of that, you know, that for some people, they would have been, if they're at home, they'd have been thrown out of home. They would have been ostracized by their family, by their communities. They probably would have lost their job. You know, there are cases, there's a case of a guard which only recently came to, it was released in the media in 1982, around the time of the Child Self investigation, where the guards were staking out the Hirschfeld Centre, which was a gay disco nightclub near here. And they saw this guard going in to the nightclub, just that. And solely on that basis, he was dismissed. He lost his career, treated very badly, you know, by the Gardaí. Although now, in recent years, he's got an apology from the commissioner. But he lost his job.
Your life career. Completely upended.
Yeah, totally, yeah.
You were involved in activism with the Cork Gay Collective in the 1980s, and you helped organise the first gay pride parade in the city. Given that environment that you have just described there, did you have a sense that you were doing something under observation, under surveillance, doing something that came and carried with it a certain risk?
To be honest, no. And I was a young person, you know, like I was like a lot of young people. And especially in those days, you know, there was a lot of political ferment. We were Bolshevik, in other words, you know, like we would have regarded ourselves as socialists. There was a huge, you know, in the 70s in Ireland, there was a huge kind of flowering of protest and resistance and subversion. And so there were all sorts of people who were trade unionists, you know, there were people who were struggling for their rights as workers, women, as feminists. There was an environmental campaign, you know, there was the civil rights campaign in the north, which was hugely energizing and empowering. So we were the Cork Gay Collective were a group of, you know, young gay men mostly. And we were, you know, very highly attuned politically, very committed, and as I say, very Bolshy. We weren't taking any nonsense from anybody.
You didn't really care about the threat. You knew that standing up for your rights was the right thing to do, and you were willing to take the consequences, whatever they were.
Totally, yeah. And one of the things, I suppose, to put a kind of a nuance into it is that the action by the Garda wasn't continuous. And it wasn't complete throughout the country. You know, there were spikes. You can see it in the data of prosecutions and convictions. There were spikes every now and then. And in Cork, there, you know, we were an organised gay group, but we weren't aware of any people being prosecuted, for example. Or, you know, There were the usual cruising places, you know, where the guards could have picked people up, you know, for not necessarily for having sex in public, but just for kind of, you know, hooking up like in public. But that didn't seem to be happening in Cork. And the story goes, like, was that the kind of chief superintendent in Cork had a gay son. And he was quite flamboyant and all that kind of stuff, and was out and about, and basically they didn't want to come across him, so they kind of laid off. But you know, that's a kind of an interesting and amusing story, but is, I suppose, not to do away with the awful things that happened in places like Tullow in 1969-70, you know, where there was a kind of basically a witch hunt against gay men, and 20 people, including those juveniles, were prosecuted.
And that was in the late 1960s, where there was this cluster of court cases involving up to 20 men in Tullow, including three juveniles who were 15, 16 and 17 years of age, who were charged under the anti-gay laws that were then in force in the state. Tell me about those laws that were in place in this country for decades. Many of them were carried over from British rule, but we really applied them with a certain force and vigour in this country. I mean, there's some great research that has been carried out by Avril Earle. She's one of the few historians who has researched criminalisation in the earlier period, and she found that there was actually a massive increase in prosecutions in Dublin after independence. 18 men were prosecuted under British rule here between 1900 and 1920. That skyrocketed, she said, to 390 from 1924 to 1962. Why do you think that was, Kieran?
Well, I suppose one of the reasons was like that the British and the police and the courts, they were more interested in keeping an eye on nationalists and Republicans, and that was their greatest like priority. And so, like, gay men didn't, I think, really feature on their radar, and they weren't too bothered. But the new Irish state in 1922, the so-called Free State, which is a bizarre term given what they got up to. I mean, it was a very conservative state. It was a very repressive state. It was dominated by the Catholic Church and by very conservative groups like Cumann na Gael and so on. And like the criminalisation and the way that it was hugely, viciously, in a sense, implemented by the new Irish state was parallel to the very conservative and reactionary approach by the Irish state towards women, for example. You know, through the contraception was banned completely. Divorce was banned completely. And there was a whole kind of regime of trying to control, especially young people, I suppose. You know, like there was the church and the conservative forces didn't like people enjoying themselves and tried to control things like dance halls, for example. They tried to control people's sexuality and you know, the Magdalen laundries, the industrial schools, and the mother and baby's homes were all an aspect of that state and church trying to control and restrict and repress people's sexuality, and the use of the anti-gay laws was an aspect of that.
And there's a really interesting piece in the Irish Times over the last couple of days, which Brian Sheehan, another well-known LGBTQ rights campaigner, had written. I believe you contributed to that piece to Kieran. And he writes about this case that was in Rathmines in Dublin, where a Gardaí climbed into the garden of a house in Rathmines that had been divided into apartments, and he peered through the window, and he maintained that he'd seen sexual activity between two adult men in this apartment. And based on his evidence alone, the two men were prosecuted, convicted and sent to prison.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really bizarre case, you know, that that was in the 1970s, you know, not in the 1870s or the 1920s or whatever. And it was a Garda sergeant, you know, like a person with responsibility. And it shows you what the criminalisation, what impact it had on the guards and on the judiciary, that it made them feel that they could do something like that, that they should do something like that.
That was the right thing to do.
Yeah. And that the courts, you know, the courts could have said, get away with it. You know, what are you doing? Just wasting police time in surveilling people who are in their own apartment. Like, what about privacy? And I suppose that's one of one of the worst things as well is that, you know, you were saying how the laws were brought into the Irish state and they were confirmed. The laws were confirmed by the Irish state as late as the, you know, 1980s. David Norris took a case to the High Court. The High Court said that it's right that gay men should be criminalised. And basically saying that it's right that gay men should be sent to jail. And then the Supreme Court, which is meant to uphold our human rights, our civil rights, our rights as citizens, equally upheld that criminalisation. And that was in 1983, although the Chief Justice, who was at the time regarded as a liberal, Fine Gael background, TD and all that kind of stuff, and was regarded as kind of liberal, but he was kind of vociferous in 83 in saying this was outrageous and we had, you know, like how dare David Norris take this case almost. And again, just basically saying it's right, you can and should be sent to prison and the Irish Constitution won't stop that.
All of it, though, I think fed into a wider culture, didn't it? And fed into a different environment, I suppose, than we would see nowadays in a courtroom. And something that really stood out to me was the use of the so-called homosexual panic defence, including the killing of John Roach, which we'll come to in a minute. And just to explain what that is, this was this legal defence that was put forward by the perpetrator's team to suggest that the perpetrator's actions against a victim were somehow provoked or somehow justified, or that you maybe could mitigate against what they had done because this person had perceived a threat or had felt frightened or offended by an advance that had come to them by the victim who would have been the same sex. And it was accepted quite widely in the court as being a valid legal argument.
Yeah, again, that, you know, I think what one of the things that criminalisation did and the criminal laws did was that they said to people, you know, and to the state, like to the courts, the guards, that gay men's lives don't matter that much. You know, you're a criminal. What you're involved in is criminalised, and what happens to you as a result of that, you know, well, that's kind of tough. Another example of that is the Declan Flynn, the trial of the killers, murderers of Declan Flynn, and they got off with suspended sentences. Again, I think because it was a gay man and his life didn't matter that much.
And Declan Flynn and John Roach, they were killed a day apart. And the John Roach case, for people who don't recall it, this was a man, he was 29 years of age, he was stabbed to death at the Munster Hotel in Cork City. And Michael O'Connor had pleaded not guilty to his murder. And O'Connor had claimed that they had engaged in consensual sexual acts before the killing took place in the hotel, but that John Roach had been killed because he had tried to make O'Connor gay. I had to kill him. He would have ruined my life. He wanted me to become a gay. I said no way, and I killed him. And that was the legal defence that was put forward in that case. Quite exceptional.
It is. It's incredible that the judge didn't say you can't say that. You know, this man.
I mean, he was charged with manslaughter in the end. He was convicted of manslaughter in the end,
and got 5 years, and probably got out in, you know, in 3 years. But I mean, it's great that you mentioned John Roach because he's forgotten about that awful inhumanity that happened to him, the fact that he was murdered, and then that the state like re-victimized him all over again. And we need to remember all of those human rights violations and kind of celebrate, in a sense, or remember the lives of those men.
Let's bring our listeners up to today, I suppose. The beginning of March, we're now in this commitment by the government, finally, that they are going to bring in the legislation to disregard these convictions. What does that mean?
I suppose there's two things that it means. Is that there's now those men who are alive can you know, get the redress so that it can be said by the state and their criminal records can be amended so that it was as if no criminal conviction happened.
Do we know how many men will be impacted by that?
It would be hundreds, I would say. And a really good thing that hopefully will be in the legislation is that there could be posthumous disregards so that, you know, the family or the partner or whatever of a gay man who had died, they could apply for a disregard, you know, in their memory. I think it's, you know, it's really important for the individuals, but I think it's also really important for us as a society and a state that we are going beyond the apology of 2018 in the Dáil and the Seanad, and we're now saying in a statute, you know, that this was wrong, and we're now righting that wrong.
And as you say, that might involve reaching out to individuals who are now spread all across the world because so many of them would have left Ireland because living with that and stigma made their lives impossible here.
Totally, yeah. They would have fled.
I'm conscious too that we're recording this podcast, Kieran, at a time when we can see gay rights being rolled back across certain parts of the world, including here in Europe, even in some EU member states. It is a reminder that progress and equality isn't guaranteed, is it? And it's important to still have these conversations because of that.
Totally. I mean, I think it is really important. And it's very important, I think, for the LGBT community, but also for wider Irish society to realise where we've come from, you know, that happened, those human rights violations, the fact that people's lives were destroyed, happened, and happened in historic memory. And so that we can learn from that to make sure that it never happens again, and that we're, as you say, that we're careful and aware and to struggle against any attempts to roll back on the progress that has been made. And I think there's a particular case for transgender people, that there's a sense that they're being picked on because there aren't many transgender people, and that they are being targeted by the right, you know, throughout the world and in a sense in Ireland. So we have to be very, very vigilant.
Kieran Rose, thanks so much for being my guest
today, Kieran.
On News Talk Daily. And it was fascinating to go back over that period of time. But as you say, it's something I think that is worthwhile, and I hope our listeners enjoyed it. That's it from the podcast today. Your thoughts and comments, they're always welcome by email to newstalkdaily@newstalk.com. Until the next time, from me, Ciara Doherty, Slán agus Bealach.